harm, Jenny Hayden. Hello and welcome to episode 172 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other star-crossed wanderers as masterpieces. I am Nick, the resident alien of the podcast, and I am joined, as ever, by Roger.
I guess that leaves me the widow, then.
And we are back into one of our favourite directors, John Carpenter, and we, as we work our way through his oeuvre, we have reached 1984's Starman.
Which is quite unlike most of the other films of his we have talked about, because it was not one that where he came up with the concept, he wrote the script, and then he scrabbled about for money. This was an actual studio production that they employed him to do.
Yes, around. It's very 80s Spielberg-esque wonder. There's a lot of parallels with E.T. in some respects, but it was a script that was doing the rounds, and Carpenter was semi-hot at the time, I believe. Not as hot as he had been.
He was not a first-choice director. I mean, they talked to, let's see, Adrian Lyne, who went on to do Flashdance. They talked to John Badham, who did Blue Thunder, which I liked but nobody else did, and War Games. They talked to Tony Scott, who went on to do Top Gun. They talked to Peter Hyams, who went on to make 2010. He was not a first choice.
Can I say I'm very glad Tony Scott didn't go anywhere near this film. But unfortunately, they let him near other films. So
I picture it now. You know, here are the macho aliens fronting up to each other, and over there there's some woman for some reason.
That would have been a love story between the researcher and the...
Yeah.
Anyway.
So the original script was bought by Columbia, and this is the days when Michael Douglas is a power at Columbia.
The script was predated E.T., I believe. And I mention it because you could argue it's an E.T. ripoff, which is why it's worth pointing out.
Well, we'll come back to that, because they made changes specifically to make it look less like that. But this was just before they bought Spielberg's Night Skies, and you haven't seen Night Skies because it never actually got made, but this was going to be the next hot thing after E.T.
It was really not
a sequel to Close Encounters, but a conceptual sequel. You know, Close Encounters is the aliens are mysterious, and Night Skies was definitely going to be playing on the whole alien abduction, the aliens are bad thing.
There may have been an element of Spielberg abandoning this, because as I recall, he'd done Jaws, he was the wunderkind, then he did Close Encounters, everyone loved him, then he did 1942, and it was an absolute disaster. So he may have been scrabbling about and thinking, I don't want to do this.
Also, after making Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is another, everybody loves him, he felt that he'd got too stressed with the whole bad guys, Nazis, he didn't want to do another explicitly bad guys as a big part of the film, at least at that point. And if you look at E.T., yes, it has bad guys. And a lot of Night Skies got recycled into E.T., obviously not the evil aliens bit, but there were a lot of elements there. It wasn't going to be
an amazing ending to E.T. if the ship that comes down is actually a warship full of warrior E.T.s ready to kill their president.
I think the basic framing for Night Skies was that there is a family and they are victimised by the aliens, effectively.
Well, he would go on and do that later on with them, which I haven't seen, his version of War of the Worlds with a Tom Cruise presumably running very fast with a serious look.
Oh, surely not. I mean, he's such a flexible actor. But anyway, certainly after Raiders, at least he said, he just didn't want to do that whole the enemy is a big part of this.
I see.
And so eventually that project was abandoned. But yeah, that was what was in the air. Yeah, aliens were in the air still. Not capital A aliens, obviously. That will take a few years later. So yeah, it's going through multiple rewrites. Carpenter, well, yeah, one of the people who does the rewrites on this is Dean Reesner, and for complicated internal WGA reasons, he doesn't get a credit on the film, even though Carpenter felt that he had put most of the work into the script he actually made.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Spielberg's quite famous for not allowing people to get credit when they've worked on scripts, but Carpenter's pretty generous generally, isn't he?
Yeah, he couldn't override that, but what he did do was put in a special thanks to, and the WGA made a lot of noise and threatened to get the thing pulled from distribution and so on. They didn't get anywhere in the end, because he didn't actually say special thanks to Dean who wrote the script. He just says special thanks to Dean Reisner.
For no particular reason.
So, yeah, and then...
He also didn't compose the music for the film.
Yeah, this is very much a studio film. He didn't get much say in the casting. A bit, but it definitely wasn't the whole... I get to pick the actors I like, as we've seen with most other Carpenter films. Also, that when it was being made, E.T. came out.
Oh, awkward.
Yeah, and the studio thought, holy crap, we cannot release this as it's currently written.
Well, so I guess the broad parallels are that this is a story about an alien that comes to Earth, and has to get off Earth and is hindered by Earth's, or specifically America's government, which wants the alien for research and nefarious purposes.
Yeah, and in the original version of the script, he could fly.
Okay. Well, he can briefly when he's an ephemeral spirit right at the start.
But yeah, they changed quite a bit. And I think the more important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is this is not a kid film, whereas E.T. is very much focused on the children.
Well, so I saw this as a kid, and I loved it. It's interesting to come back now, and we'll talk about how or whether my feelings have changed. But I think even as a kid, I preferred this to E.T., I think. But it was much less talked about. It was way less of a success. But it's a funny combination of a love story and a road movie.
Mm. I suspect that E.T. gained a lot in any notional competition simply by coming first.
Yes.
And there's enough conceptual similarity that audiences would have thought it was a rip-off even if it wasn't. So,
well, a similar thing happened, well, not quite. Alan Moore did, for 2000 AD, did a comic series about Skiz. That was a similar thing in that he was handed basically a rip-off of E.T. He handled it very well, but that is much more explicitly, it's like a cross between E.T. and Boys from the Black Star. it is really good, but I don't think he's that proud of it. But obviously it was very influential at the time, E.T., as Spielberg was just influencing culture heavily in these years.
Yeah, I should just note that since I have never seen E.T., it is technically eligible under Ribbon of Memes rules. That I have no intention of seeing it, and I suspect you have no intention of seeing it again.
I don't want to revisit it, actually, because I loved it as a kid. I suspect I would feel differently now, and I don't want to... betray my younger self. So
not to mention most of the copies floating around these days, they've digitally erased the guns in the hands of government agents to replace them with walkie-talkies. So yeah,
let's not go back.
So more importantly, here's Karen Allen. We've seen her before in Raiders of the Lost Ark for Ribbon of Memes. And we thought she was bloody great. You've seen her more recently in the more recent indie films?
Well, yes, she was in Indie 4, where I don't think she was particularly well served. She has a kind of cameo in Indie 5, but it is handled much better because she's actually an aging Marion Ravenwood there rather than a kind of comedy character as she is in 4.
But... I look at her and I think, why wasn't she not amazingly famous and popular and successful and so on? I mean, she had a decent career, but hasn't shown up in a whole bunch of films I like.
I'd say it's a good question. I mean, she is beautiful and she is a really talented actor, I would say, because she's a different character here than she is in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And she's just, you know, plenty of male actors have gone on with and done very well with less range than she has.
Mm.
And I totally agree. I think she's carried on as a kind of a jobbing actor.
Yeah.
And survived, whereas a lot of Hollywood actors, actresses, I suppose, I'm going to say specifically, do not, because they reach a certain age and they are replaced by a younger model.
Yeah, though I think there is one bit of commonality with Raiders, which is she's really good at portraying somebody who, you know, she's seen a better life and it hasn't always been good to her, and she's just carrying on because that's what you do.
She does kind of world-weary and cynical in a way that still leaves room for wonder and hope. I find it, yeah, very endearing kind of quality there, I agree.
And we also have Jeff Bridges.
You have got me wondering with your offbeat comment earlier. I wonder how this film would have been with Jamie Lee Curtis, also a fine actor.
I'm not sure what she's like at this point.
I mean, more Jamie Lee Curtis, I would be very happy to see in anything. That said, I wouldn't like to see it at the expense of Karen Allen. They're both fine, but it's just got me wondering. They should have done it again, only had Jamie Lee Curtis as well. She's great.
Opposite her, we have Jeff Bridges, whom I found much more convincing here than he was in The Big Lebowski. A more sympathetic character, as far as I'm concerned. But he, at this point, his career has survived two really major flops. Because he was in the 76 King Kong. And the 1980 Heaven's Gate, that famous flop.
He was in Heaven's Gate.
Yeah.
I wonder if we should watch that at some point, because it's become such a terror. There's a reason I don't want to, and that's because it has got a history of cruelty with animals. It's been one of the reasons but it's been so vilified as a terrible film, it makes me want to watch it perversely.
Yeah, Ishtar similarly.
Yeah. We'll consider.
But his last major role before this was Tron, and that was basically, okay, he is now taken seriously.
I wonder about Tron. Even at the time, this isn't a Tron film podcast, because I've been thinking about it, because the latest Tron Ares, just came out, and has sunk and done about as well as any other Tron film. I don't know why they keep making them, because they never do that well at the box office. And the original Tron, it's okay. I mean, the thing about it was how it looked, the visual style.
Mm. Similarly, The Last Starfighter, which, as a story, is frankly dreary. But it had revolutionary CGI.
Yes. I mean, these are films that I have a great fondness for because of the time I saw them. I wouldn't want to go back to The Last Starfighter now, but I flipping loved it at the time. But I agree with you. Anyway, back to Starman.
Yeah, so the basic idea is, you know, this is the Pioneer plaque, including the sound recording.
So it's Voyager 2.
Oh, okay, Voyager plaque, sorry.
That went on, Pioneer went to Mars, did it?
No. Pioneer was the one with the plot for the outer solar system and interstellar space.
Oh yes, but they had a similar one on both the Voyager probes, I believe.
This has been found by aliens, and let's not worry about times and distances and things, because this is not the sort of film where you know about the speed of light.
Well, Voyager's only just left the solar system. For certain definitions of the solar system, it has only just left the solar system.
It certainly hasn't reached anywhere else.
No, still in the heliopause. Anyway.
There is a planet full of aliens, and they find this thing, and they get the message saying, come and visit. And so they think, right, well, we will come and visit, or one of us will.
Yes, we seem to have sort of an alien scout who isn't planning to crash land on Earth, but he's shot down by Roger's aviation corner can probably tell me what he's shot down by.
Well, it's actually two different aircraft, because this is not the sort of film that has the budget for actual aircraft. They use stock footage. They are beautiful aircraft if you like that sort of thing, which I do. Got a pair of F-102 Delta Daggers, which are the interceptors taking off.
Right.
And then the ones that are that we see in the air are F-20 Tiger Sharks, which are an Okay, the basic idea, the early 80s idea was America will sell war toys to its allies, but not quite as good as the ones it has itself. And so the F-20 is deliberately designed to be, it's basically a development of the F-5 because Northrop got the contract for it.
Okay.
And it is deliberately designed to be pretty good, but not quite as good as an F-16.
Did nobody buy it?
To a first approximation, yeah, it was never a great success, possibly because people knew this. Also, it was still in development when Reagan came along and said, ah, no, we'll sell you anything. We'll sell F-14s to the Iranians. That's going to go well. See previous Ribbon of Meme. At least two previous Ribbon of Memes, in fact.
Yes,
Argo
the
and
Top Gun
Maverick. Yeah. But anyway, so basically it no longer had even a notion of a market and the project was cancelled. But yeah, this you can see them. They say F-20 on the fin. This is clearly promotional footage.
So they like
reused.
The iPhone SE of the plane. what
we also get, there's... When they get to the point of lifting the wrecked spacecraft out of the where it's crashed and into some more series, they've got a heavy lift helicopter, which is a Sea Knight, well, a Vertol 107, which is basically a Sea Knight without the military bits.
Okay.
With a Columbia helicopter's livery on it, and basically, yeah, though you might think in this situation they would use actual military heavy lift. But that is an actual helicopter rental company. They specialise in heavy lift helicopter rental because, you know, you need one for one job. You may not need to operate one as part of your permanent payroll, and that's where they come in.
That was their job. Okay.
Well, they're still going. They've actually got to the point of applying for a certification so that when they do a full maintenance on one of their helicopters, they can certify it to fly again because the people who made them aren't making them anymore.
So they branched out into obsolete models, a speciality kind of.
Yeah, because nobody's making heavy lift helicopters now. But anyway.
Anyway, they are our scout character. We never sort of see him because at this point he is an indefined kind of... It's not clear whether he's a ball of light permanently or whether this is sort of an escape mechanism. But anyway, his ship is shot down and he becomes this, or it becomes this ball of light, which travels across... to an isolated cabin, which contains the recently widowed, we think recently, Karen Allen, or Jenny Hayden.
I don't think they specify what happened, I think, but it's accident rather than cancer.
I think she said he had cancer, an accident, yeah.
Which makes a change. I mean, the thing I very much appreciate about this is that she is set up as a widow rather than a widow and single mother, which is would be the cliche, and it would certainly be what Spielberg would have done if he'd had this script.
Well, we'll come back to the mother thing.
Yeah.
But yes, at the minute, yes, she is... still in the acute phases of grief, as far as we can tell. She's still, again, however long that lasts, but she's still struggling. But our wee spaceship man comes along and finds a lock of, Hayden, what's his name? Anyway,
yeah.
Jeff Goldblum. Let me try that again. Our wee spaceship man comes along and finds a lock of her husband's hair, and clones himself, or
we don't even need a science corner at this point, do we? You really can't recover DNA reliably from hair. You can get some from the hair buds, maybe, but
maybe he's got like an AI that reconstructs it. Anyway,
from the thing that has none of the relevant information,
he blends it with that of frogs, and he becomes a fully grown replica of Jenny Hayden's husband.
Which, strangely enough, does not find reassuring.
Well, we have this slightly disturbing special effects sequence of the rapid growth of the baby done by, I think it was Stan Winston, who did the American Werewolf in London, or Rick Baker, possibly.
I think it was Rick Baker.
One of those geniuses of special effects. But because this isn't a horror film, it is slightly disturbing watching the growth of this.
I did note down at the start of that, my goodness, that is a very unconvincing baby. But then given what it has to do, I suppose that's not entirely surprising.
Yeah, fair enough. It doesn't look real, but then I guess you could you could say it's not. It gets a pass for being that. Okay, so we have the resurrected, sort of. He has no memories of... He seems to have some kind of body memory in that he has reflexes and he can use his... But there's a moment when she tries to escape and he sort of pulls his gun on her in a very kind of practiced move, so it suggests he's got some body language. But Bridges does... I mean, I've always liked Jeff Bridges in most things. I love him in The Big Lebowski, but I'll accept your heretical point. But here he really is quite good. You could argue it's quite gimmicky, like my canonical example of gimmicky would be Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys playing the Madman. And you could argue here he's doing very self-conscious. I am an alien. This is a body that I have never had before. I am getting used to how the arms and legs work. But for me, I don't know how it works
because we have no real examples of that happening, whereas we do have real examples of people who are mad.
Yes, exactly. I agree. For me, it works really well. He's just got this very distinctive, a bit like the way Robocop moves in a very distinctive way. He's just got this very, I am working out how this neck works kind of movement and doing it kind of in, he's almost like trying to move digitally in an analog body, doing these kind of specific short bursts. It works really well for me. I can see some people might find that distracting, but for me, I find it quite endearing. It worked well for me.
And I found myself thinking of the process of development of children, and so much of the interface between body and brain is, in effect, software. When babies are waving their limbs around, a lot of that is building up mappings that they say, okay, you know, this sensation in the brain is right arm, for example,
yes.
Or this particular set of things is an object in front of me that I'm seeing. And
he's does a good portrayal of someone who's never gone through that process or gone through it very quickly, had a crash course in it.
And yeah, so. She is suspicious, and one of the things I like about this is she does remain suspicious for quite a long time.
Yes, as you would do. The MacGuffin, if that's the right word for this thing, but the plot hook is he needs to get to Arizona, the Arizona crater.
This is very much a backup plan. He was not intending to be shot down. He was intending to make contact with the people of Earth. This is basically the emergency bailout. And so, yeah, quite possibly he was aiming for somewhere a bit closer to that. It's not that it doesn't feel a little bit forced, because obviously it is a little bit forced, but it doesn't feel blatantly, no, this plan makes no sense, the way a lot of them seem to.
Yeah, it's not fridge logic, is it? You're not like, hang on, but why? It does make sense, it just feels a little convoluted. And the further slightly convoluted thing is, but again, it makes sense, if that's how it is, that the body that he has made is either unstable or can't survive, or there's something about the Earth's atmosphere, but he's dying. He can't continue to. So if he doesn't get off Earth, he'll die. Whatever that means for this creature.
One of the things I like about this is he doesn't seem terribly concerned about that. I mean, he's giving her information because this is relevant to what she's doing, but one feels that it's just part of what he expects, whether that would mean he would survive in some other form, or whether it means he's an expendable scout and he is prepared to die because that's part of the mission. I don't know. It doesn't matter, really. The point is, it's there.
Well,
not just the standard human approach.
Exactly, yes. And again, it's not clear whether he seems unconcerned because he can't express emotion. But consequently, the film becomes a road trip with, you know, these two very different people. But I find it a cool, interesting relationship. Karen Allen, you know, has got a weight of acting to do to deal with the fact that she's now faced with the object of her grief. Her husband is back, but it's not her husband and she's being kidnapped. And so that's a hard kind of relationship to get across. And he's having to do I have no idea what's going on, and I'm having to trust this person to get me where I need to go, or I'll die. So, he's done
the thing that is meant to reassure her of appearing like something she's familiar with, and it hasn't worked. What's going on here?
It doesn't work properly. So I find straight away I find that a compelling story. So I'm hooked, and again, I loved it as a kid, and at this point in the film, I'm in with it. Really, they're both actors I like. They're both they're both selling the story, which is, you know, a bit ridiculous, but they sell it well.
It's been a while since we saw a road trip through the American Midwest.
Yes.
Or American West, I should say.
Well, semi-Midwest, isn't it? But I can't remember especially where she starts from. Is she in Colorado or somewhere like that? No, Colorado's too close to
everything. It's somewhere east. Basically east.
Yeah, Pennsylvania, yeah. Maybe. Anyway, they take a trip initially with Scott, the facsimile of Scott. Kind of, he gets hold of a gun. There's a nice episode. There's a nice moment where she just sort of faints into a box, and he's utterly confused. Like, she sort of sits down in a box and passes out. And he's just utterly confused about what's happening. It's their relationship as actors. They have chemistry.
Mm.
The little moments where she's desperately trying it. So she starts writing, I've been kidnapped. And she tells him to, because he doesn't know how roads work, she tells him, you know, run this red light or run this orange light to try and alert the authorities that she's been kidnapped. So it starts off quite a contentious relationship. And I find it quite compelling. It's a weird one. You're kind of rooting for both of them. You totally understand why she's doing that. You don't want her to escape, but you understand why she's behaving like she is. It's good. I'm in for it.
I can't remember now where the quote comes from, but it's something along the lines of the real tragedy is not the triumph of evil over good, but the struggle of good versus good.
Yes, and it's that kind of friction. We also have a cutaway to Charles Martin Smith, who I don't know if we have had on the podcast before.
I don't think so.
But he's I think he's specifically a SETI researcher, is he? But he is an expert in such as things exist on Earth in 1982, an expert in things alien. And he's recruited by the baddies. And I suppose these fall down a bit. They are a bit... They're stereotypically bad government.
Yeah,
there's still a sort of anti-authoritarian streak to American cinema at this point.
John Carpenter
exactly, particularly anti-authoritarian. Though he doesn't go as far as he often does in other films. See Escape from New York, particularly.
I think it's not so much that they are blatantly evil as that they never bother to suggest to him that he should be anything other than evil or that they are. I mean, it's just assumed.
I just felt there was a bit, there's a bit where to show the difference between, there's a moment when he comes into a room and he's like, what's that? And, the baddie government agent, who is Richard Jekyll, I think. But he's basically dismisses him as them. He's like, oh, it's a dissection table. I just thought it was a bit, you know, ominous. Yeah, maybe that's what we needed.
And the visual framing. Oh, yes, here is an ominous dissection table with restraints.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Heavily implied vivisection table. Anyway, so they pretty quickly, the authorities pretty quickly, they know what happened because they shot down a thing and then they found the ship. And it's not a meteorite, it is a spaceship, or it's hollowed out, so it's clearly something.
And one of the things Mark Sherman, the SETI researcher, is doing is basically trawling local news for stories of weird shit happening.
I like that. You know, sometimes you have lines that come back to you through your life from films you watched long ago, and I periodically find the words... yelled greetings and melted his lug wrench floating into my mind from watching this a long time ago. Don't know why, but there we are. It stuck with me. What I like about this as well is it doesn't spend too much time in convincing anyone what's happening. You know, Karen Allen doesn't need convincing because she can see there's something very obvious, weird going on. So she does believe he's an alien quite quickly. Charles Martin Smith is already quite credulous, or his Sherman is quite a credulous character. They've got, I like that they don't piss about that the authorities have got enough information. They already know there's something very weird going on. He pieces it together. Perhaps you could argue quite quickly that this guy is, that this alien has assumed the resurrected form of Scott Hayden. But with the, they kind of skip the bit where he works that out because, well, it's the logical conclusion from the evidence they have.
They do start with Scott Hayden is dead, the death was registered.
Confirmed dead, yes.
And the eyewitness reports of somebody who looks extremely like Scott Hayden.
And that happened right after this thing happened. So, yeah, they piece it together quite quickly. So then it becomes a road movie with a chase that gets more and more intense as they go on. So then we have a picaresque story of them, well, road movieing across the West, encountering various things. We learn that Scott is slowly losing his marbles, literally in that he has magic marbles that can do special things, high-tech marbles that he's got a limited number of them, but he can heal things. He can actually resurrect the dead with them, as we discover at one point, much to the annoyance of some redneck hunters that he resurrected deer and lets it go. I have said before, no one does wonder like Spielberg. But I've started to wonder, because I feel here, I get that sense of wonder. You know, it could be a bit hokey, the moment where Scott's character brings the deer back to life and releases it out into the world. I'm still touched by that, whether that's a memory of things as a kid, but I find it moving. I like the music. I was surprised Carpenter didn't compose the music, because it's his sort of music. Whether he had an influence, I don't know, but it's kind of a repetitive theme that goes on in a dee 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 dee, and then it does that a lot, which Carpenter does in his music sometimes. So I always assumed he'd composed it. But anyway, the combination of the cinematography, Jeff Bridges selling this kind of innocent, slowly we get, it worked for me, and slowly we get Jenny falling in love with this other character who isn't her husband. And I think whether you like the film or not hinges on whether you ship that love story. So how did that work for you, Roger?
I found myself convinced. I mean, as I said, it got points from me for not having a cute kid involved.
Yes.
Yeah, because that it probably wasn't a cliche at this point. It would certainly become a cliche later.
Yes.
But it works. I mean, she is grieving. She is possibly making unwise choices, but she's aware of that, and she's a lot more self-reflective than characters are normally allowed to be.
Mm.
And that very much works for me. And could you call it falling in love? Well, maybe. I mean, they know that whatever happens, it's going to be a limited term relationship.
It works for me.
I think it's going to be picked up, or the body's going to die. Either way, she's not going to see him again. So,
yes.
You know, she is never under the illusion that she's going to build a new life with him. But even so, this is somebody she will go to trouble for, will potentially wreck her life for, become a federal fugitive, whatever.
Well, it's interesting. It's in some ways it follows a kind of Terminator path, in that it's a very short-term relationship. Consequently, it's going to be, you know, idealised. You never have to buy a dishwasher with this guy or pay the mortgage or anything. Again, I want them to get together. I am sad that this amazing thing is ending. I'm interested what's going to happen after the film, because towards the end, so they do grow closer, we see the wonder of him. They don't have apple pie in space, apparently, so he's very happy about eating. Mm. It's implied that he doesn't eat in the same way that humans do, or they're some kind of, again, the implication is they are some kind of transhuman species that have evolved beyond their bodies in some way, and so he is experiencing how nice it is to have a body for the first time.
Like. Yeah, the only thing that doesn't really work in that respect is when the government crew are poking into the crashed spacecraft, there is a seat suitable for a human.
Yes, yeah, that's...
Which they really shouldn't be.
The props guy didn't do wonders there. I'm surprised they left that in, because it just... the relationship worked for me because it's this short-term thing, and I'm moved by it. I have some slight issues with the... So right at the end, he's like, oh, I popped a baby in you last night, or however you'd probably put it more romantically than that. She's pregnant, and then he becomes this kind of... It starts to have some religious overtones then, you know, he will grow up and be a teacher, and there's kind of a Jesus parallel that sort of that he is going to be in some way him. My worry is like, okay, the authorities have already got her in custody at this point, presumably, and now they know she's pregnant. So how is that kid, what is going to happen to this kid at this point, given the... So I worry about that, but thankfully the film...
Also, you know, you ask first, not afterwards.
Exactly. I was a bit surprised that was a non-consensual... It wasn't non-consensual sex, but it was... if he knew he was going to do it, maybe he should have checked first. Instead, he does the kind of, I can do a like retroactive abortion, if you like.
Well, given the time involved, it would be retroactive contraception very much the same as a morning after pill.
But well, I guess
that
so,
hasn't
yes.
been, that hasn't yet been invented at this point, so...
So then we finally have the kind of the meeting between the Charles Martin Smith's character, Sherman, and the Starman. I have Charles Martin Smith. He's in The Untouchables too. And a few other things I've seen. But he's got a very expressive face, and he gets across this kind of, he sells it to me anyway, this is a guy who's wanted to meet aliens all his life in a positive way. He goes into this diner towards the end when they're at the crater in Arizona, and he meets the alien, and just, you know, selling that kind of, holy shit, here's one right now.
And at the same time, he's having this reversal. I mean, he's always been working with the government, and he's got to the point of, no, I actually need to work against the government now, even though this is going to destroy my life.
Yeah, so I wonder what happens to the wreckage that's left behind of these poor sods. But that meeting where Jeff Bridges tells, Scott tells Sherman about, you know, what he finds beautiful about humanity, it sells the hope. I'm blubbing at this point, and even now, as a cynical, jaded adult, I loved it. Again, I find there are some problems I have with the film, but not huge problems, because I just get carried away with it, and I enjoyed it. And then we get to the end where Scott... how did that scene work for you, that kind of final talking scene, I suppose?
Well, yeah, I wasn't desperately fond of Sherman as a character, but I thought that everybody involved sold that really well. I found myself convinced, and that is basically what I ask of a film. So,
yeah, that's fair.
This is consistent with who they have been up to this point. It is sensible things that those people would say in that situation. Yeah, I like it a lot.
And then the film wraps up relatively short. This kind of peril, helicopters, they go into the crater.
Yeah, I feel if you want to catch him for dissection, opening your negotiation with anti-infantry rockets is perhaps a little extreme.
That seems a bit unnecessary to me, even as portrayed. I mean, that guy's going to be facing a board of inquiry, isn't it? He's like, so we were going to pick through the bits of the alien where you work out what happened. I feel like he was overstepping the mark a little bit there.
There was one thing that I felt a viewpoint that somebody should have expressed, and quite possibly Sherman should have expressed it. That, you know, he casually melted that guy's crowbar. What makes you think we will have a chance against him, and do you want to be the person who started the first interplanetary war?
Yes, if that's just one of them who's crash-landed, what about an away team from their ship? Maybe we shouldn't... Yes, very good. But it's not... Because it's not the sort of film where we are talking about bad aliens and why that might happen. I totally agree. And, you know, you could make a fairly convincing argument from the military's point of view. Look, we have no idea what we're dealing with. This could be a humanity-ending event. Mm-hmm. We need to take this seriously. So you could have humanised the government a bit more, or at least explained their perspective a bit more.
But, I mean, this is a fantasy.
It's not the sort of film where we need some generic baddies. You don't need to express the Nazi's perspective on things in every film. So there we go. He gets taken up to go back to the religion. There's a lot of religious parallels with these alien-type films. That's where the film ends. So we never find out quite what happens to Jenny or her son or Mark Sherman. Presumably, being the sort of film it is, it worked out okay. But yeah. But there we are. There was, weirdly enough, a TV series of Star
Yeah, I had never heard of this.
And it's got... I had heard of it years ago and then forgotten about it. It's got Robert Hayes from Airplane in it as Starman, which I can see working, but I don't think it lasted very long.
It was a single season. As I understand it, the basic idea is it's 15 years later. The kid is now a kid.
It's not selling it for you already, is it, Roger?
Well, no, I mean, 15 is, yeah, you can cope with 15. Outside the range that really annoys me. But Space Dad comes back, kid teaches Space Dad about humanity as they look for Mum. And I believe in the season finale they found her.
Okay.
But she has basically done the Sarah Connor and gone into hiding.
Oh, I'd be interested in just following up the story, maybe. I'm not sure about actually watching it. But I might read a synopsis. Okay, that's the summary. It sounds like it worked for both of us. Again, I've said before, all I really want to do for a film to do for me is to move me in some way. Either sort of get me angry, not in a kind of, we've got to get the bullet out kind of way, which happened to me listening to an audio book on the way home that got me very angry. But this moves me emotionally. I am sad as to what happens. I think it is largely, this could have been a very bad film. It could have been very hokey, embarrassing. It could have been badly acted. It could have been badly directed. It's none of those things. Everyone who's doing it is very good at what they do. Consequently, it works brilliantly for me. And yeah. I still love it now, having seen it all these years later.
I've complained before about feeling emotionally manipulated by a film.
Yes.
At the same time, if I'm feeling an emotion as a result of watching a film, that is the result of manipulation. Somebody has set that up to produce that emotion in me, probably. Unless it's, my God, this film is terrible.
I guess what you don't want is to be aware of being emotionally manipulated.
Yeah, and just as obviously any plot is constructed, but it shouldn't feel constructed. And on both grounds, this film is a success for me in that regard.
Yes.
I did honestly enjoy it, and I'm very glad to be able to say that.
I'm pleased to hear that. I had a horrible feeling you would not be a fan of it, because I really enjoyed it a second time. It also warms my cockles that Carpenter can not only do horror amazingly well, and thrills, and comedy, We Have Big Trouble in Little China, he can also do the Spielberg thing pretty well as well. He's very versatile. I don't know why he's not one of the most famous directors that ever lived, but there we go. You know, Hitchcock had one trick. He did it very well, but that was his stick, wasn't it? He did suspense. Carpenter's maybe that's his problem. Maybe he's too versatile. I don't know. I know he didn't invent the slasher movie, but he popularized it. He did body horror better than David Cronenberg, I think, in The Thing. He does comedy amazingly in Big Trouble in Little China. He influenced our hobby hugely with, I don't think either of us had seen Escape from New York before, but we kind of felt like we were coming home watching it because of the influence it had on all the kind of role-playing games and board games and things that we had. And then he does Spielberg as well and does it really well.
Yeah, maybe he's just embarrassingly good. Certainly, when he's worked with Hollywood, the more he's worked with Hollywood, the less happy he has been with the result.
And so, that happens to a lot of people, but yes. Yeah.
But I really liked this. I'm not going to say it's a masterpiece. Quite maybe. I could Fair be convinced, enough. But. It's a little crude in terms of the plotting and the characterisation,
yes.
But it does it really well.
Well, I think that's it. It's not super original in a lot of ways, certainly not at the time, but it just what it does really well. I don't know whether now is the time to talk about masterpieces or how we're feeling about them. Shall
we leave that to the next one?
Okay, let's leave that to the next episode. But I'm increasingly less interested in whether something's a masterpiece or not, and just whether I enjoyed it. As far as, is this a masterpiece? I think probably not. It is a bit derivative. One of our definitions is, does it do what it does, like, to the apotheosis of that thing? Almost. probably doesn't quite get it into a masterpiece. But I loved it anyway. So.
Yeah.
Let's leave it there.
We'll be right back.